June Melby's family spent every summer at a cottage on a lake in Wisconsin, but theirs was not a life of leisure. They were the owner-operators of Tom Thumb Miniature Golf. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. June Melby was 10 years old when her family bought the miniature golf course, and that was the end of lazy summer days and family vacations. But it was also the beginning of many other adventures. 30 years later, when her parents sold the course, she was surprised by her reaction to losing this family venture. She's written about her childhood, her family, and of course, miniature golf in My Family and Other Hazards. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When June Melby was 10 years old, her life changed forever when her school teacher parents spontaneously decided to buy a Tom Thumb miniature golf course in Wisconsin. She's written about her summers spent in the ticket booth, scraping and painting and perfecting her cotton candy twirling technique in the new book, My Family and Other Hazards. She now lives in Decorah, which is the town she grew up in as well when she wasn't working on that Tom Thumb miniature golf course. Hello, June.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
And your parents were both school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You are one of three girls in the family. So you were 10 years old when mm-hmm. this happened. Your little sister was what, about six?
She was six.
And how old was your older sister?
She's 3 years older, so that would make her 13.
All right.
Right.
And so you're on a family trip in Wisconsin.
Right.
And what happened?
I love the way you put that. That's about right. Well, in central Wisconsin, that's where my mother is from. We were visiting my grandparents, and there is a miniature golf course we played at once each summer while visiting my grandparents. And one year there was a for sale sign, and my parents thought nothing of it. Okay, oh, that's interesting. But the next summer went back, and there was the for sale sign again. And this time my dad thought, oh, that's really interesting. What if, you know, dot, dot, dot.
And they asked you guys about it, right?
Well, they did. You know, the funny thing is that my parents were school teachers. They'd never run a business ever. So it was just on a whim. You know, my mom says, oh, it just fell into our laps. But, you know, school teachers in Iowa are really well respected, but they're not really well paid. You got to find some way to make some extra money. And so, frankly, my dad grew up on a farm and had to work really hard. And he confessed later, well, you know, he didn't want us kids just lying around in the summertime. He wanted to make sure we had something to do, quote unquote.
So they said, hey, kids, what if we buy this miniature golf course? And you guys were thrilled.
Of course.
Right?
Oh, yeah, because all we knew was like, hey, oh, wow, really? We're going to play all the time. It's going to be a big party. It's, you know, Disneyland in the backyard.
So they buy the golf course. And then, of course, the school year comes.
Yeah.
And they didn't ask about the business plan for the golf course.
Yeah, that's funny because I guess apparently that's normal when you buy a business that you ask, can I see the books? You know, how much money do you usually make and what should we know? But they didn't know you're supposed to do that. The course had been built in the late 1950s by another school teacher, and he thought it would also be a really fun way to spend the summer and just made it by hand with whatever he found around. And he was ready to retire, so he just handed over the keys, and my parents were like, okay, I guess now we'll
do that
too. Figure this out.
And so he didn't give them plans for the different holes, for the different hazards, and they didn't ask for that?
That would have made a lot of sense, don't you think? Well, you know, what happened was, so the previous owner, who was a very nice man, and really well-loved. So his last summer, the summer my parents bought it, when he was storing everything away in the garage at the end of the season, my dad went and watched him because, you know, it's winter in Wisconsin. It's crazy. So you can't leave anything out. And these are all hand-built. They're sort of like the equivalent of dollhouses that the guy made intricately. these little wooden thingies, and you don't leave them out. So he'd haul them into the garage every fall. So my dad went along to watch how that goes, but he didn't take notes or anything because he didn't realize that would have been a good idea.
Right. So you go to Iowa. You spend the winter in Iowa.
Yeah.
Your parents are both teaching all winter. School gets out in Iowa just a little bit earlier than in Wisconsin. So,
yeah, that's true.
So you get done with the school year, it's Memorial Day. Your family packs up on a Friday night, drives up to Wisconsin. You're getting ready for the first unofficial day of summer, I guess. And you don't have plans. and the whole golf course is in storage. So what was that very – I know your dad loved to talk about this. What was that day like?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. I think every family has a story or two that they tell each other. Every Thanksgiving and every Christmas,
right.
Repeatedly, about, oh, you remember that time you drove the truck into the ditch and all the geese got loose, or one of those, like, you know, a disaster at the time, but like you need to replay it to each other. So the story that we tell each other is the first day, the very first day, because it was a disaster. And I tell about it in chapter one. It gets a whole chapter, that one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and actually, I know that you also describe the first hole in that chapter. And that's how you have set up the book. We go hole by hole through the Tom Thumb Miniature Golf Course. So why don't you introduce us to hole one, and then we'll talk about that first day.
Okay. I have 18 chapters, one for each hole, because it seemed like it would be a fun idea. And so this is the description of the first hazard at hole number one at the beginning of chapter one. Okay. Most miniature golf courses have a first hole that is designed to be easy. There is a statue of an elf, say, or a lighthouse, and a fairway that's lined up with the hole. Simple. Par two. Customers sink their balls effortlessly, then move on feeling good about themselves. Confidence equals fun. Because people come to mini golf as they come to life, with expectations. That they will be good at it, for one. That they won't look too foolish, for another. Even if they don't come out a big winner in the end, they have good reason to believe it won't be entirely unpleasant. It is a game, after all. But the thing about Tom Thumb is that it's never going to be as easy as it looks. Our first hole, the Rocket, merely appears uncomplicated. You will think all is well as your ball leaves the tee-off pad. You may say, looking good, as it toddles down the middle of the fairway. Then, 4 feet away, the ball will start to drift. No, you may yell. Or you may pace tight-lipped. Or you may stand stock-still and open-jawed. But in any case, your ball will bonk the side of the opening. Then it will rebound to bonk the other side of the opening. It may rebound again, and possibly again, but regardless of the number of rebounds, when it finally comes to rest, your ball will be under the hazard and unreachable. Always. Now what do I do, is what you might say if you happen to be like most people. Your best bet is to realize that you are a mere mortal. Lie down on the fairway. Use the handle like a pool cue and tap the ball towards the hole. Try not to think about the wetness that will appear on the front of your clothes, your own personal shroud of Turin, when you finally stand up after your prostration on a wet carpet. Hole number one, the Rocket, is about expectations.
That's June Melde reading from her memoir, My Family and Other Hazards. And as you go through and you describe each one of these hazards, and that's what you call the sort of thing that marks the hole, the thing that makes the hole difficult, I guess, is
yeah,
the hazard,
there's something, there's a tee off and there's a green, and then there's some kind of obstacle between the two, and that is called the hazard. It's the same in regular golf, or as we call it, maxi golf.
Maxi golf.
We call
that's
it maxi
great.
Golf.
In the trade, right?
Well, yes. You know, if you start it, maybe enough people will pick up on it. Mini golf and maxi golf. I don't know why not. They also have hazards, yes.
Right, right. So on that first day, of course, you have to, as you mentioned, all of the stuff goes into the garage. Almost all the stuff goes into the garage every winter.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, here it is, the morning that you're supposed to be opening, and you guys need to get all of that stuff out onto the course. So how did that go?
Well, you know, the first day was the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, which for most people is the first day of summer.
Right.
So they are
the biggest business day of the year for a miniature golf course.
Yeah, it is. And so people were used to coming to this mini golf since 1959, and this is the early 70s now. So it's been around for a long time. So people had a tradition of going there.
Well, so, and I'm sure, as you point out, it's too cold to swim.
Yes.
And so mini golf is very attractive because
yes.
you want to do something summer-like, yes. but you can't get in the lakes.
Yes. We call it mini golf weather. When it's cold, like it is today in Iowa,
right.
it's strangely cold today. This would be perfect mini golf weather because you don't want to go in the water. It's like 70 outside. You know, water is not appealing. So this is mini golf weather. So people started showing up. So Saturday morning, Memorial Day weekend, cars started pulling into the parking lot and, you know, expecting to play. And we're standing out there. And, you know, when you have a miniature golf course, when you don't have the lovely hazards and the turning windmills, when that stuff is not out, it sort of really looks like a graveyard. I'm not exaggerating because it just sort of sticks where the hazard should be and there's the riding posts and there's nothing. It just looks bleak. So the tourists were sort of lining up along the fence, just staring out at us, wondering, you know, what's happened? Are you going to be closed forever? And meanwhile, we're scrambling. We're trying to figure out how things fit together.
And I love the estimates that you start giving. Your mom is the one who's giving estimates. The first tourist show, but well, we were opening at 10.
Yes, we'll be open by 10. Come on back. Sorry. And then a little bit later, we'll be open at noon. You just come on back. Thanks so much. And then we'll be open at 2. Don't worry. We'll be ready then. And then you just kept going and all day long. No, it'll be another hour and another. And then, you know, and they kept showing. And, you know, the busy time of day also was at a mini golf is mid-afternoon. So they were just, they kept piling up. So it added to the stress because, you know, how many times in your life, you know, you're faced with a deadline and an impossible task, but then there's an audience.
Right.
Watching.
This actually sounds like a classic stress nightmare. But you were living it.
Yeah. Now it's a great funny story. At the time, of course, we were just panicked. And, you know, my parents were busy doing all the grown-up things. My dad was doing the heavy lifting, hauling these, you know, these were handmade obstacles. So, you know, the castle with doors open and close, it's made out of wood and 2x4. It's a heavy, heavy, heavy object. These things they're not manufactured in some factory in Atlanta and shipped up north. You know, they take some TLC. and they all, because they're handmade, they're fit together oddly in so many shims.
Right, you know, right. So when did you open?
6:30.
6:30.
And we still weren't even ready. Finally, my dad just caved in because he felt sorry for someone like, this woman shows up with her young boy and it's like, okay, fine. Okay, I feel sorry for you. Yes, go ahead.
Play.
And then we just ran ahead of them, putting down tee off pads and stuff.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to June Melby. She is the author of the new memoir, My Family and Other Hazards. She'll be at Beaverdale Books tonight in Des Moines at 6:30. And tomorrow night, she'll be in Cedar Rapids at New Bow Bookstore at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with June Melby, and she's just published a new memoir. It's called My Family and Other Hazards. It's about her childhood spent working in the family business, a Tom Thumb miniature golf course in Wisconsin. Her parents were school teachers in Decorah, but every summer, she and her parents and her sisters went to Wisconsin and ran a Tom Thumb miniature golf course. And we were just talking, June, about the very first day when it was very clear that everybody was totally in over their heads.
Yes.
But you also had an epiphany on that first day because, you know, you weren't a child that refused to help your parents with things, but you kind of had a feeling about how much a child should be expected to help. I love your description. You were talking about cleaning out one of the pools. You and your younger sister were cleaning out one of the pools, and you say something about how, well, we fully intended to do this job poorly so that mom would have to do it anyway. But that first day, was that a shock to you when you realized, oh my gosh, we are going to have to work?
You know, the first day, I tell you, you know, if you're out on, you know, this graveyard of a course as a family, and then there is them, the tourists, the customers lining up along the fence. And they also came by water because we were on a peninsula on a lake. So they're coming by streaming in by boat. And, you know, there was an us and them sort of feel. So instantly you realize we are in this together. And I think it really did bring us together. There wasn't like, you need to help us work now. It's like, holy crap, we need to make this not a terrible, terrifying situation. And I can only compare it to, like, you know, people who grew up on farms and, you know, there's a big storm coming in. You don't ask what you're supposed to do. You run around and figure out, you know,
what can you do
because the storm is right there and here you are. What you gonna do? You know, it was really a lot like a family farm, I think, you know, instead of a swarm of locusts, we have a swarm of like 50 Boy Scouts, age 10. I mean, similar
to a swarm of locusts.
Same risk, same right. Worry.
So as things shook out, as you got into a routine, what were your jobs?
Oh, what weren't my jobs? I mean, honestly, I think everything except the motors, because that was my dad's job. My dad was, he was a high school teacher of chemistry and physics, but he was actually sort of a really wanted to invent things. His favorite thing is to make up very complicated miniature golf hazards because he really wanted people to have the best time possible on a mini golf. And his vision of that was to make very elaborate hazards, many with flashing lights and motors that opened and closed. So he would go off into his garage workshop and in the wintertime basement workshop and make increasingly complicated, crazy hazards. You know, many of them involved like roller skate wheels that rotated. I'm not making this up. It just sounds like, what? Roller skate wheels that rotated on hand-carved wooden cams and switches. And that was his job. so I did about everything else.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so did your mom.
Yeah.
And you describe your Mother's Day. And you know, I know that your dad was really sort of the face of the miniature golf course. He was considered to be the owner and the operator of the miniature golf course. But your mom was the one who kept everything clean and everything running. And that's no small task.
No. And with three kids running around. Yeah, she's the one who really kept it going. But whenever I said that, she was like, oh, no, you know, huh. The Midwestern women are, you know, very strong, very capable, and very willing to pass off the credit to someone else.
Right.
It's classic, isn't it? I mean, isn't that really, you know, the Midwestern woman just can do just about anything and stronger than she will admit, you know, not showing visible muscles like the people who go to a gym. But yet, you know, when your back is turned, there she is heaving a bench over to somewhere else so she can vacuum the green of number 14, which always flooded after a rain. She kept the place going. She was pretty awesome.
Well, and you talk about what people are doing on a farm if a storm is coming. Tell us what people are doing on a miniature golf course if a storm is coming.
Well,
because
that's funny.
I mean, you talked about how your dad created all of these very intricate hazards, and they were motorized. Many of them were motorized. So that doesn't sound very outdoor friendly. So what happened if it rained?
Well, you know, his baby, the first hazard he made was rotating barrels, which is sort of a classic mini golf hazard. And you actually can mail order a rotating barrels from a catalog, but they won't look awesome. He made it by hand with like slats of oak that he nailed to a round metal can he got from the bakery in town that was left over from holding lard or something like that. Anyway, all handcrafted from materials. Okay. But he varnished it. And, you know, varnish isn't really an outdoor friendly thing. So that hazard, whenever there are any spots of rain, one of the first things we do is call out, I'm going to cover the barrels. And they run out with the old tarp and cover them. So they got babied. It was how you knew there was rain coming because we're all covering the barrels.
That first summer, how much money did you make?
Oh, no. Oh, what if my family hears this? I don't know. We didn't make much. You know, the course needed a lot of upkeep. It had gotten a little run down. You know, it had been out there since late 1950s and really you need to. So I can't remember the dollar figure. I think it's in the book. Dollar figure, it's pretty darn low. It's a lot less than the expenses.
And your parents never took a salary ever in all the 30 years that they ran this course.
Well, that's the other funny thing. You know, most people when they run a business are hoping to actually make money. And they actually decided not to do that, which confounded and frustrated the heck out of me, especially as a kid. But they, well, first many years we didn't make a profit. We were running at a loss. But then, even then, they decided they were going to only charge as much money as they would like to pay if they were a family on vacation themselves. But, you know, they're school teachers. So what they would like to pay is not very much. So they, you know, they actually ran it as a service, you know, kind of as a mission. And we worked really, really hard to keep everything in beautiful, beautiful, well-painted shape, you know, for other people so they would enjoy it without, you know, while we were wearing secondhand clothes. And I learned how to sew my own clothes. You know, that was nice because we didn't have money.
Right. You got paid for your work, though.
We did. You know, not a lot, you know, but saved some money away for college. Yeah. But they never paid themselves, no.
And it is interesting. And now, of course, I know that you're writing this with hindsight, but...
Oh, sure. A little bit of hindsight.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a lot. 30 years worth. But your description of your sisters and yourself and what you learned about your personalities, it seems like this experience was really... not just formative for the three of you, but also an opportunity to really figure out what each one of your strengths were. So how did it shake down? What was your oldest sister's role?
She is also very capable. She was so strong. I mean, she still is, but as a teenage girl, I mean, she was very confident. I was not. I mean, I was a typical middle child, just kind of in the background moaning. No, just complaining about my state. And she was so strong after the first few years when we kind of got things caught up and running, we didn't actually need all five of us all the time. My uncle, who had a canoe rental business in the area, hired her to go help out. And so the job she had was pouring cement. He was making a moat for boats to travel, like a little amusement park ride. So she's off pouring cement free time.
Right, and she was the only female employed by your uncle.
Yeah. So the other employees were all teenage boys, and they liked her very much.
I'm sure.
She was very popular and suntanned, cement.
When you describe her, you use the phrase repeatedly. She knew what she was doing.
She had a different childhood than I did. She read the book and she said, you know, it's really good, but you know what? We had different childhoods. And I go, yeah, I always suspected that, you know. Thank you for confirming it. Yeah.
Now, how about your younger sister?
She's awesome. She, you know, when we started, she was only six. And so she didn't have responsibilities. And I was so mad. I thought, that's just not fair, because I was only 10, but I had to step up and do most of the grown-up activities, you know, including wait on customers without a cash register. We kept the money in a fishing tackle box because that's what the other owner did. So you had to make change in your head and make change. And right. I just did it.
Same box, too.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think when they sold it, you know, when this book begins. Yeah, this same fishing tackle box was handed over with a dent in the top and an old decal of a leaping fish on the top from the 1950s.
Wow. But your younger sister, when you're reflecting with her, she also makes a joke about feeling about her status was about on par with the family dog.
Oh. You know, well, yeah, I think what happened was, you know, it's a family business and it gets a lot of attention. And, you know, Tom Thumb was like a member of the family and it was almost like the other child. So she probably got a little forgotten because Tom Thumb was like the child that got all the attention, you know, maybe like a special needs child who you just love, but really is falling apart a little bit. So, yeah, she came out probably better than the rest of us. So what do you know? I don't know what that says.
I'm talking with June Melby. She is the author of My Family and Other Hazards, a memoir about her life growing up on a Tom Thumb miniature golf course in Wisconsin. So where did you fall? So your older sister was in command, very confident,
oh, yeah.
Great at giving commands, you point out repeatedly.
Please forgive me for saying it. Oh, no. You got to tell the truth when you write a memoir. I mean, you just have to. You just have to also apologize a lot to your family members, or hope they trust you.
But right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your little sister, you say, was somewhat overshadowed by the golf course. What were you?
Oh, I was it's funny because there's three of us. We're so different from each other, and we even look different. You know, my older sister's really dark, dark skin, dark hair, dark eyes. People thought she's American Indian. My younger sister was very pale and fair and appeared very fragile. And I was the middle, and I'm brown hair, middle, just medium height, just not extraordinary. And I had a hard time trying to keep up with the grown-up half of the family, who were, you know, my parents, my older sister, because I really was trying to, I don't know, find awesome ways to attract attention to myself. And in that setting, the way you attract attention to yourself is being a really good worker. So we were like a worker bee family. And the way you garnered attention was finding creative ways to make Tom Thumb a better place.
And your older sister was exceptional
at
that.
She was so good at it. So we had a garage that was crazy, you know, again, inherited from Greg, who built the place. And it was – he didn't clean it out. Are you kidding? When he handed over the keys. It was just – it was sort of like a junkyard at an amusement park many years after the fact, literally. So we'd go explore the garage to see what we'd find to enhance Tom Thumb. And we'd find all kinds of crazy stuff. She was great at it. One day she found like a water pump, and she's like, I'm going to go fix the fountain. I'm like, what fountain are you – we don't have a fountain. Go, yeah, that pile of rocks over there, that's a fountain. Are you kidding me? It looks like a pile of rocks. I had no idea. And so she got a lot of attention because she figured these things out.
But you obviously also did a great deal of work, and you worked in the ticket booth, and you mm-hmm. worked in the snack shack, and you handed out the putters, and you helped people keep score. And on a day-to-day basis, you did a lot around mm-hmm. the Tom Thumb miniature golf course, and I'm sure that as you grew, you did even more around that. And you didn't take days off?
No, except once. You know, my birthday, we'd take off.
You and your younger sister.
Yeah.
Just the two of you. Because
yeah.
Nobody else could take the day off.
Correct. You know, it's summer. Summer is 3 months long. Exactly. You got to be open 7 days a week. You know, 12 in the morning to – no, 12 in the morning. 10 in the morning to 10 at night. So there was no occasion when we all leave. So, yeah, during my birthday was great. And my sister and I had the day off. And it was awesome. And we would get on our bikes and bike to the state park, which was about a mile and a half away. And you could sneak in the back if you're willing to bike on this sandy, rough road.
Which we did. Right.
And then we, you know, go to the swing beach. And then am I giving away a story? I think we, you know, this is true. Here's a confession. When you write a memoir, you have to confess these dunny, crazy things. The highlight of the birthday was sneaking into the campground and taking a shower. And I'm just like, it's true. You can read the details. It's hard to explain, really. But, yeah, we did it the first time just on a whim. Just like, hey, let's take a shower in the campground. We don't have a shower at home. We just jump in the lake. And this would be hilarious to pretend we're campers. And then it was so fun to sneak in. We did it every year.
That was your birthday treat, sneaking into the campground to take a shower.
Oh, Charity. I think it's the sneaking in part was the thrill of it. Like we're doing something almost illegal.
Did you take soap after that first year?
I think so. I think we did. It was such... Because it really was for many years. Even when we were, you know, back at Tom Thumb from college, I think I'm confessing way too much here. This is so crazy. Yeah, but we did. It was just the thing we did. It became our tradition, and we loved it. We'd hang out at the swim beach. We'd have a whole day, but a picnic, right. Lunch. We didn't just shower because that makes us sound way more easily amused than we already were. But you know, we didn't get a chance to go camping ourselves. So it was a way to,
right?
I know.
Well, and this really was the end of family vacations.
You bring up all these happy things, Charity. Yes. It was. We didn't have any family vacations of our own after that. But, you know, you got to understand, we were in a setting where everyone else is taking their vacation. So we actually got to vicariously enjoy everybody else's vacation because people would show up to play mini golf every year, the same people every year. It wasn't like the kind of tourist place people come and go after a day or two. They had cottages that had been in their family generations, and they came every year, and they laughed, and they laughed. And so, you know, there was a real upside. There was a real upside to it.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with June Melby, who lives in Decorah, Iowa now. She's written a memoir called My Family and Other Hazards about the family business. Her parents were school teachers, but every summer the entire family went and were the owner-operators of a Tom Thumb miniature golf course. Did you spend your summers when you were growing up working in a family business? Let us know your story. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with June Melby. She is the author of a new memoir called My Family and Other Hazards. She'll be reading tonight at Beaverdale Books in Des Moines at 6:30. And then tomorrow night, she'll be at Nubo Bookstore in Cedar Rapids at 7 p.m. The memoir is about her summers spent on a Tom Thumb miniature golf course in Wisconsin, a family business. And if you have stories of spending your summers working for a family business when you were growing up, we'd love to hear them. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And June, like so many other young people who grow up in the Midwest, who grow up in Iowa in particular, you took off. After you were eager
yeah.
to get out.
You know, I think because we weren't making money, and I was quite convinced that I deserved something better, really. So I didn't want to just be waiting on other people. That was very – had this great sense of entitlement. So I took off after college, and I moved to California to pursue big dreams. And I was pretty sure, you know.
Well, you were on the cusp of being famous for quite some time.
Oh, the cusp is a long stretch of horizon, though, isn't it? I mean, the cusp stretches quite a long distance. Oh, yeah, I don't know. I moved originally to San Francisco. I really thought I was going to become a rich and famous rock musician, and I brought with me my accordion, and you know, I played keyboard and stuff. Pretty quickly, I realized that people in bands are wonderful people who are more than a little unstable. So I switched gears into – I started doing comedy, where it's just you and you don't have to worry about other people showing up, and loved it. Much to my surprise, it was wonderful. I really enjoy the experience. You can just get on stage and you can say anything as long as you have a laugh every 5 to 7 seconds, you know. And then I drifted down to Los Angeles.
But you didn't – I find this fascinating. You did not do stand-up about the fact that you grew up on a Tom Thumb miniature golf course.
That's funny, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really talk about it.
It didn't seem too easy or
– It seemed too hard. I mean, how do you explain – you know, it's just – it was just one of those things I didn't actually reveal very often at all. You know, it was something I considered a second or third date confession. Oh, you know, by the way, I grew up on a miniature golf course, you know, kind of muttered, you know, my comedy was much more abstract and less personal. I didn't want to be that revealing. Isn't that ironic?
Well, and you had some mixed emotions about this golf course.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't want to make fun of my parents either. You know, if you were on stage doing comedy, talking about your family, you're usually making fun of them. And the way you do that is by putting on a funny voice or a funny accent and mimicking them in a way. And I didn't want to do that. I really wasn't, you know, I was out pursuing my dreams and I was definitely pretty sure that they were dumb. You know, staying at the mini golf course working for no money. But I wasn't about to, you know, have fun at their expense. I'd rather just sort of forget about it.
So as time went on, your feelings started to evolve, whether you recognize that or not. But at some point, you actually thought, you know, eventually I will go back and I will run the mini golf course.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I thought, well, I'll just strike it rich and get my own sitcom. And then after that's underway, and then I will move back to Wisconsin and I'll be the conquering hero and take over the family business so that they can retire and, you know, be that very special person of the family, you know, like the way family farms are passed down and someone else, you know, keeps it going. But then by the time I hit 40, realized, well, I could barely pay rent. And my career was kind of in the pooper, as we can say. So at the time that they needed to retire, I really actually had nothing as far as bank account is concerned.
And the property values, as many people who have tried to have a cabin in Wisconsin or used to have a cabin in Wisconsin know, I mean, the property values on these beautiful lakes in Wisconsin just kept going up and up and up. You write quite a bit about how you responded when you got that phone call from your mom and said, there's a buyer.
I freaked out?
Right.
Yeah.
And before we dig into those feelings, I would love for you to read a little bit from your book about, as you call it, the first time the world ended.
Yeah. This is also about being a middle child, I would say. I remember the first time the world came to an end. I was 11. It was November, and I was late getting home from school. I had lingered too long at the dime store, staring at the birthstone rings and candy. Then at the library, I examined the arts and crafts books, which I considered my private collection. By the time I got home, I was 2 hours late, but the house was empty. Mom? Leanne? Mom was usually in the kitchen by this time, and Dad asleep on the couch after a long day of teaching, his white socks removed and draped like flags of surrender on the armrests. Instead, the house was perfectly quiet. That's it then, I thought. It is the rapture, and I have been left behind. Well, okay, I thought. Locusts? Are there going to be locusts? Isn't there something about blood that rains down from the heavens? Luckily, a few weeks earlier, my parents had taken us to a movie about the end times showing at the local college, so I knew what to expect. There would be plagues and computer chips embedded in our foreheads, and when the police came to arrest you for not having a barcode in your skin, you were supposed to run off and live in the woods like a caveman. I opened the fridge and helped myself to tater tot hot dish. God had reached down to snatch up the true believers and carry them off to heaven. If you had even just a teeny tiny bit of doubt, you would be left to suffer tribulations and then maybe hell. I couldn't remember the details after that. But there would be no warning. Cars would crash and planes would plummet. I was probably walking up Washington Street at the time, a street so boring you'd never notice. For dessert, I ate ice cream directly out of the container as I stood in front of the fridge. Sure, I'd had a few doubts. Church took a long time. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. That was my favorite part, the part at the end. And I did believe in God, probably just as much as anyone else in my family, but it hadn't been easy. They cut Bible characters out of felt and pressed them on a felt board in Sunday school. That was really dumb. Felt doesn't stick, and grown-ups should realize. I had a problem with a lot of things like that, the way my mother washed plastic bags and clipped them onto the clothesline behind the house, the way my father sharpened pencils. They were already sharp. If God was going to leave anyone out, it would definitely be me. My sisters were happier. They didn't ask as many questions. My younger sister even looked like my mom, my older one like my father. I was a grumpy kid, and maybe, I thought, that's enough for God. If it's Judgment Day, and you're God, and you get to pick your roommates for eternity, I can't say I'd blame you if you leave behind the grumpy.
June Melby reading from her memoir, My Family and Other Hazards. And so that was the first time the world ended.
But that was the first time.
You had a similar, well, maybe not exactly the same reaction, but you really were surprised by the depth of your emotion when you got that phone call from your mom And she said, okay, we found a buyer for Tom Thumb.
I was so surprised. I mean, we knew it was going to come eventually. Because
it had been on sale for a year.
It had been on sale for a year. And, you know, my sisters were both in the Midwest, married with kids, and they weren't capable of just running it. So we knew it would come eventually, yes. And yet, it was just a shock, complete shock. It's almost like hearing about the death of a loved one. Even if you know they're ailing, it's just you don't think it's ever going to happen. And I totally freaked out. I mean, I just completely was devastated. And so I flew back to spend as many days as possible at Tom Thumb the last summer and just take it all in again and just try to figure out why does this place mean so much to me? It just sounds really sappy, but it's totally true.
It meant a lot, not just to you, but to your parents, too. I mean, I am struck.
Well, to everyone, to all of us, actually.
I'm struck by the fact that when they put the golf course up for sale, the realtor told them that they could actually increase the property value by tearing out the golf course.
Yeah.
And not just by a little, but by a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, now, you thought maybe by $500,000.
They would be, you know, the realtor said, tear out the miniature golf course. This land is worth so much, you could become millionaires. So, you know, who was ever faced with that kind of dilemma? You know, all the place where you've put all your time and energy and heart and soul into for 30 years, if you are willing to destroy it, you could become a millionaire. You know, who is faced with that kind of crazy choice? And of course they said no. It's been around now for, well, how many years had that been? You know, 45 years. It's a tradition for so many people. There's no way. And you know, money was never
a
motivator.
So that was an easy decision
for
them?
Oh, yes.
Well, you talk about them running it almost like a mission. And I mean, and clearly they did. And your parents are clearly very intelligent, very loving individuals. But why? Why did they think that miniature golf was so important, of such value to the community, that their time, their effort, all of that hard work, and not really making very much money, why was that worth it to them?
Well, you know, that is the million-dollar question.
Literally.
Quite literally. Because it wasn't just miniature golf. It was a tradition. And people had been going there for many, many, many years. And the last summer, people were coming up and thanking them for keeping it going. And then they were telling us their story. I've been playing here since I was five, and now I'm here with my five-year-old. Thank you so much for keeping it going. And there's a couple who played there during their honeymoon 20 years before. And so every summer, they came back to play on their anniversary. And there's a family reunion. No, there's a zillion family reunions. A part of their family reunion tradition is the last day to all go play miniature golf together. And you hear these stories and you realize, wow, you know, they did it. I mean, my parents did it. They were actually really successful. They did it. They wanted to provide a place for other people, and they did. And, you know, isn't that success? Isn't that wonderful that they were actually able to contribute to these all these people, all their vacations and their family, happy. I mean, it sounds so lofty, but it's actually true. And I came to really admire that. You know, how awesome is that?
You describe your mother's family in one of the passages in the book. You have a sort of an impromptu family reunion where you're all together, and you describe her family as being ridiculously successful.
Yeah.
And did your mom think of herself as successful?
No. Those are more.
But so was she conflicted about that, watching her siblings achieve what most people would consider to be success in life, where, you know, she was a teacher and she ran the Tom Thumb golf course?
You know, I don't actually know. You'd have to ask her, you know. And this is one of the questions I really wanted to put on the table when I wrote this book. What is success? Because I had gone out in search of, you know, one version of the American dream. I have decided to measure my talent, and I want to challenge myself and run off to the coast and see what I can make of myself and make some money for me and draw attention to me. And their version of the American dream was, we believe people should be generous. We believe not charging too much money. We believe being a service to the community. And we believe that people shouldn't be drinking alcohol while they're swinging their metal clubs as well.
You went through many iterations of signs to try to communicate that.
Yeah. So the grounds of the course was like their own utopia. And they, you know, they put picnic tables out in the yard so people could picnic there for free. And we painted the picnic tables and we worked at making this. It was a park. There aren't really a lot of public parks in Waupaca on the Channel Lakes. And so we provided one. And their version of the American dream is living your life in a way that you hope other people would. Just whether you're not, consider it as a model or just living it. And so one of the questions I wanted to try to figure out was, so which is, you know, which is a better version or the American dream? I don't come up with any answers. I just like posing the questions. I don't know. But it was interesting to me.
This happened at a very pivotal time for you personally. I mean, as you mentioned, you were about 40 years old.
I just turned 40. I had just been dumped by my boyfriend who was 14 years younger than me, and I probably shouldn't have been dating anyway. I was broke. I was really kind of done with Hollywood. It really didn't fascinate me. I loved performing. And I had been doing a lot of performance poetry at the time, which I loved, but it wasn't going to pay the rent. You have to tour a lot to make money, that which is fine, but I was 40, you know, sofa surfing was losing its appeal. So I was also at a It's not a turning point if you're not turning, is it? I mean, if you're just wondering, I don't know what to do next. What's the word for that? You know, it's once you
crisis?
Make it. That may well be. So I thought, you know, I still, you know, as the days counted down, I was still thinking, if I could just find a way, I could take over Tom Thumb. I could be the person in the ticket booth who welcomes them. Welcome back this summer. So good to see you. Look how you've grown. I thought if I could find a way, I could be that person. I could be like my dad and mom, you know. So I really didn't give up to the last second.
Right. And even though you weren't able to take over the golf course, in some ways, this was the moment that brought you home. You never thought you'd come back to the Midwest. This was the beginning of that turn.
Cue the music. Yeah,
right.
I mean, yes, it really, you know, and I think that's when I realized, okay, if I can't afford to buy it, then I'm going to have to write about it. That's my only way of trying to capture it. And that's why I set out to try to write the book for just very very personal reasons. You know, the fact that people like it is a blessing. It's just a gift because I really was just – I learned so much. I mean, I really learned about life in a goofy setting. I mean, it's such a goofy place. And yet, you know, it's like the life's lessons are just there.
Well, and you kept learning. I mean, that final 3 weeks at home,
yeah,
seems like a time where you really learned a lot about who you were and who your family was.
You know, and also fell apart on a regular basis, sure. You know.
That's part of learning for a lot of us. Well, June, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's been a real pleasure.
June Melby is the author of My Family and Other Hazards. She'll be at Beaverdale Books in Des Moines tonight at 6:30. Tomorrow night, she'll be at Nubo Bookstore in Cedar Rapids at 7 p.m. She lives in Decorah. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The program is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about Parkinson's disease. This is Talk of Iowa.